Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
My name is Jeff Steinberg. Today is Tuesday, January the 16th, 2002. I want to welcome you to the LaRouche Connection. Some of you will be seeing this broadcast before January 24th. And I want to encourage all of you who are seeing this broadcast before that date to participate in an extraordinary webcast that will be taking place at 1 p.m. on the 24th, involving Lyndon LaRouche, the founder and contributing editor to Executive Intelligence Review magazine, who is also a standing candidate for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in 2004. The subject of the webcast, which has already been spelled out in a policy memorandum that LaRouche drafted several days ago and is posted on his campaign website, is continuing the American Revolution. Now, LaRouche goes into great detail about precisely what he means by the necessity to return the United States to the kinds of policies that were associated with the founding fathers, with the great American presidents, including Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in order to deal with the pressing crises and war dangers that are facing the world today. For many citizens of the United States and around the world, the events of September 11th were an experience similar to the Pearl Harbor attack of December of 1941 that brought the United States into the Second World War. It was a horrific event which brought reality home to bear for many people who had been simply preoccupied with the concerns of surviving for themselves and their families. Of course, in 1941, we were beginning to come out of the worst effects of the crash of 29, the depression that followed. Today, we are facing an international financial calamity, a collapse far more devastating than that of 1929. We are facing a systemic crisis that will mean that the entire international financial and monetary system has eroded and will have to be replaced on short notice, on emergency notice, either by a return to the policies traditionally associated with the American Revolution, the American system of political economy policies of President Lincoln, of his key economic advisors like Henry Carey, and of the policies that were again revived in the 1930s and 40s by Franklin Roosevelt. Those policies have been abandoned, virtually forgotten, by the vast majority of American academics and policymakers. And LaRouche addresses the urgent need to revive that tradition so that the United States can play the kind of leadership role that is indispensable in dealing with the crisis that lies immediately ahead of us. Now, of course, the events of September 11th have been the subject of an enormous amount of discussion in the media by government officials and others. But by and large, all of that discussion has avoided the most fundamental issue that LaRouche confronted on September 11th, and which in his own way President Bush confronted in establishing a cooperative relationship with Russian President Putin to deal with the immediate events of that day. The fact is that September 11th was not an attack from over there coming out of some caves in Afghanistan organized by Osama bin Laden. September 11th was a coup d'etat attempt organized by forces within the West, including within the United States itself, aimed at capturing the United States to a self-destructive policy of embarking on a clash of civilizations. This clash of civilizations policy has been promoted for nearly a decade by people like Dr. Bernard Lewis, the senior British intelligence orientalist in the world today, Samuel Huntington, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and others. And LaRouche has written an exhaustive policy paper which will be released in the immediate days ahead as a LaRouche in 2004 campaign documentary report, with extensive background documentation on the personalities and institutions that were involved at the strategic policy level in this coup. Over the past several days, a number of well-known international figures, including German parliamentarian Andreas von Bülow and a prominent retired Egyptian general named General Kallas, have come out with statements, public statements, enforcing the basic themes that were first struck by LaRouche in an interview that he gave on the Jack Stockwell radio show on September 11th as the events were unfolding. Both von Bülow and the Egyptian general debunked the fairy tale version of the story of September 11th that cast all of the blame on Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization, defying some of the most fundamental facts about what happened on that day. So this webcast at 1 p.m. East Coast time on January 24th is something that is an urgent matter for all serious citizens in the United States and around the world to not only listen to, but actively participate in. Now, the remainder of today's LaRouche Connection broadcast will be a continuation of last week's broadcast, in which we presented a policy seminar that took place in New Delhi, India, in late December, involving Mr. LaRouche and a number of prominent Indian policymakers and strategic analysts. Last week, we saw the opening presentation by Mr. LaRouche. Today, we will see the question and answer discussions and also hear briefly from Helga Zepp LaRouche, Mr. LaRouche's wife and the founder and president of the International Schiller Institute.
You just had a highly stimulating, thought-provoking lecture. It looked like as if we are attending lectures at various faculties, history, economics, science, education, culture, but the fact is that all these lectures are delivered by a single person in a very well integrated manner in single auditorium, and we don't have to rush from one faculty to another, to learn less. I thank Mr. LaRouche for his brilliant exposition. And before we throw open his presentation for discussion, I think Mrs. Helga LaRouche would like to say something just to supplement it with her ideas on Eurasian language, and then we can have a discussion. Will it be proper?
Yes.
I request.
Mr. LaRouche gave you the historical evolution of the idea of Eurasian infrastructural integration. Now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the idea of uniting Europe and Asia through such infrastructure corridors, and in that way elevating the populations of the previously landlocked areas to the same level before only maritime cultures enjoyed, was an acute item on the agenda. So in 1989, Mr. LaRouche had the brilliant idea, immediately after the fall of the wall, to extend these corridors eastward into Eurasia. After the disintegration of the Soviet Union, around 91, we developed the first comprehensive proposal of such Eurasian integration. And for several years, we were like lonely callers in the desert, propagandizing such a policy. And the good thing is that now, especially in the last year or so, after President Putin became president of Russia, this is no longer just an idea and a program, but many, many projects are underway to integrate Eurasia in this way. For example, between Japan and Russia, the idea of building a tunnel to the Sakhalin islands, the integration of the South North Korean railway with the Siberian railway. To have the Siberian railway open up the northern regions of Russia, which are of a tremendous wealth of raw materials and could be a tremendous source of development for the entire continent. The Chinese government, with its westward orientation, recognizing that the U.S. market as an export market for Chinese products is disappearing, is now moving very fast in the direction of connecting the old Silk Road with the European and Middle Eastern region. Egypt is playing a very important role by recognizing that Egypt is both an Asian and an African country, and especially given the extremely proud historic tradition, Egypt being one of the greatest of mankind, is recognizing that if Egypt goes back to its ancient tradition in being a promoter of universal development, that the modern function of Egypt is to connect the Eurasian language to infrastructure into Africa, and that way creating a real possibility to save Africa from an otherwise certain death. So all of the concerns which brought us to India at this point is to try to get the Indian elite in particular to recognize that, you know, a renewed effort has to be made by the planners of this country, because the moment of crisis will come very, very soon. As a matter of fact, it's not 1 second too late, because we are in the middle of this financial collapse. And, you know, if people have the right conception, then this crisis can be used to put the new world economic order based on the Asian language back on the agenda, and not only on the agenda, but to realize it. So, you know, I'm actually optimistic, because, you know, while there is a grave danger to civilization right now, the positive thing is that many forces in the world are moving to save mankind from collapse. And, you know, I just wanted to add this short remark.
Regarding your description for the future, first of all, I fervently wish that we see you in the White House in 2004.
Thank you.
That in that high position you will help implement the ideas which you mentioned about nation states in your concluding part of the address.
Thank you very much. Yes.
I'm Dr. Nirupa Sen from Current Science Correspondent for the Current Science. This is a question about a 40-year plan for the development of India, which you had sponsored. Are the plans, whatever is in the plan document, is it still relevant at this point of time? And during your visit to India, what has been the response to by the elite regarding planning for the future of India? What has been the response to this generally?
Now, 20 years later, the world has changed. It was done specifically with the idea that Mrs. Gandhi was then Prime Minister, and our intent was to provide through her, we've had discussions before in earlier times, and it seemed that the most useful thing we could do for India, since she was disposed to know about such things, was to provide something that she and her associates could use in India to devise a plan for India, that we thought that the long-term view was needed, and we thought that about two generations would be required to realize anything that India would work with accept as a long-term view. Looking, and she, of course, was sympathetic, because she would always look at the poor in India as her reference point, that if it doesn't benefit the poor, there's something wrong. And that's my view. And if it doesn't benefit the poor of India to elevate their station, we failed. If you benefit the poor and uplifted them, well, then you're moving the whole country in the right direction. And it would take two, because we were seeing things as Mrs. Saffron pointed out to us at one of the villages we visited. You could see the problem of the teachers in trying to draw, get the parents to accept that providing the, bringing the children to the schools, which the schools of teachers were devoted to trying to help these students, these young fellows. So that in order to make the revolution in India that was required, you would have to actually motivate a process in which education would really take off and people would understand the importance of supporting it. So we said 4 years. I mean, some of the things that are required were two or three generations apart. So it's still relevant. I would simply situate it the same way of thinking with some of the same objectives today.
And the second part of my question, what response has been there by the policy planners of today in the country to your...
Well, basically, it's been more of a spiritual and factual character than anything else. Coming back to India, my view of relations is largely a spiritual one, in my sense of the term spiritual. And that is the cognitive powers of mind must be engaged. You must engage in transmitting concepts back and forth, not just words, not information. And my concern has been to establish relations, or re-establish relations with people who think, who are the thinkers, or typical thinkers of India, knowing that the radiation of thinking among thinking people is the way in which science works and which politics really works. And therefore, I was more concerned to have the opportunity to report on certain things, which I thought Indians ought to hear from me, because I'm prepared to tell the truth, whereas some other people from my country are not. And the Indians should have the advantage of hearing some of the truths of the matter, so they could judge for themselves how to look at some of these problems. But mainly that, it was spiritual. What do we think? To engage, to set forth channels for the future, where we're more efficiently engaged in communicating ideas which might lead to useful results.
At this point in time, which group or grouping could be the prime mover for pushing the Eurasian corridors, giving them effect? Second question, should it come about what you're propagating? Will it, to some extent, diminish the power of the USA? And if that be the case, would they not oppose it? Thank you.
I live in a country where, for the past period, from 1977, the beginning of the Carter administration to the present, the top 80% of the population of family income bracket used to represent the overwhelming majority of the national income. Today, the 80% of family income brackets, the lower 80%, represent the actual abyss in share of national income. Which means that we are doing something terribly wrong since Carter, especially since Carter, economically. Now, I want a nation, I'm an older man, I won't live forever, I don't think. He's offered me that. Yeah. And therefore, I see this condition of my country. I say the country is not going to survive unless we reverse this tendency. The power of the United States should lie in the quality of its people and the quality of the development of its people and its historical mission. In my view, the historic mission of the United States is bring forth on this planet a community of principle among perfectly sovereign nation states, to end the last vestige of colonialism and empire in any form or guise. The point is that this complication is that any people has a certain cultural distinction which tends to make that people a suitable subject of a national identity. I mean, even though we may have exactly the same ideas, our cultural antecedents are different, and therefore we approach the discussion of these ideas in a somewhat different way, on consideration of our own respective national antecedents. Therefore, when a nation wants to deliberate, it has the advantage as a nation of deliberating in terms of shared cultural antecedents for its present ideas, even though the resulting ideas may be exactly the same as by another nation. Therefore, I think that the nation state, the perfectly sovereign nation state, is the form of society which must exist into the infinite future. We must not aspire to change that. Therefore, we must strengthen the right of every nation to be a sovereign nation state in the true sense. On that basis, we must now come to agreement on those things which are truly in the common interest of all mankind, and therefore the relation. That is my purpose. the nations, the United States, because of the superiority of its constitution, not the implementation of its constitution, which may be another story, recently, right? But the constitution, which is based on the idea of a sovereign nation state republic, a presidential republic, which I think is the proven to be the best form of republic you can have. Because you must have an institution of some degree of relative permanence, which has authority, but which also has the consent of the people. And it must be based on a constitutional, not a set of laws, but a constitutional set of principles by which the people cooperate and develop their laws. And that is the mission of the United States, to play that role bestowed upon it by European civilization in enabling us to come into being. And therefore, that's the power of desire. The United States, as part of an Anglo-American financier interest, to dominate the world as an imperial maritime power, which is the present aspiration of some in my country, I abhor. The sooner that's gone, the happier I'll be. Now, on the influence, curiously, but not accidentally, the most important influence I think I have outside my own country is in Russia. This has a long history to it, not an unturbulent history, as some here know, but it's a long history. There is in Russia, well, first of all, the importance of Russia is that there are only three national cultures on this planet which have a true sense of sovereignty in respect to the world as a whole. India has a sense of sovereignty in respect to Asia. China has a sense of sovereignty in respect to Asia. But when it comes to managing world affairs, only three cultures which will essay to manage world affairs are the British monarchy, the culture of the United States, and the culture of Russia. None of which have been colonized, none of which have been, at least not in modern times, none of which have been occupied by foreign powers, at least not in modern times. And therefore we have deep in our culture an embedded sense of authority. So when it comes to say, overturn this piece of junk called the present monetary system, an American or Russian can say that readily. Well, and the British monarchy would say, well, if we chose to do it, we might do it. That sort of thing. But the problem is that countries of continental Europe, the countries of Asia, do not think that way. They think of how do we learn to reform the existing system to live within it. Don't destroy the house, but how to find better quarters within it. And thus, Russia, which was a power, and which is a power in its instinct, responds differently than other nations. Under Yeltsin, no. Under Putin, yes. I'm not going to underwrite Putin. But I say the difference is that Putin represents a Russian president who represents Russia, where Yeltsin didn't. And therefore, whatever he does, he's Russian. He proceeds from the sense of Russia's role in a world scale. His negotiations with India are exemplary. His negotiations with Japan, especially with China. The intervention in trying to bring the two Koreas together despite the U.S. effort to separate them again. The negotiation with going to Kazakhstan, the trip of the Pope to Kazakhstan, and the implicit welcoming of that by Putin. Other things of the sort, and dealing with the United States. So therefore, what's happened is the transformation of Russia, which has gone through three phases in the century, more than three, but three principal phases, from Tsarism and its breakdown, from Lenin and what followed, to the breakdown in 1989-91. And now the breakdown of the world of the world globalization system. It's not, globalization is now effectively dead, or else we are dead, one or two. So therefore we come to a point at which you need people who are willing to think in terms of what are we going to do about the condition of this world. Not the condition of our nation, but the condition of this world. There are in Russia, there's a current which is largely centered in the intelligentsia of Russia, many of whom were intelligentsia as part of the old Soviet system, many were dissenters within that system. But they're different from the old communists, the old Marxian communists. They're different in the sense that, as I do, they see the individual as the maker of history, we do not believe in objective forces of history. We not sit back and say we have to follow world public opinion, the objective forces of history. World public opinion today stinks. I don't follow it. I propose to change it. We know we have to change it. We know we have to change the ideas within countries. Therefore, the responsibility is like that of the scientist. No scientist is worth anything if he doesn't make a revolution. No political leader is worth much unless he makes a revolution. Because there always are challenges which require leaders who can pull the institutions of society away from their habituated ideas into the new ideas that society must adopt. In Russia, around, and I've expressed this with this effort, we have two conferences in Russia. One which my representatives were at, where my paper was submitted, a recent one, on the spirit of science. Another one which will occur soon. Both involve a recently deceased friend of mine, Boris Kuznetsov, a Russian scientist of some significance, which represents the core of the Russian scientific community, who are all his friends, including all the scientific institutions. And I propose that we have a discussion, equal discussion, of the continuity of the work of Mendeleev and of Banaski. Now, I don't completely agree with Banaski's picture, but Banaski was a great scientist and a great discoverer. Very valuable for all of Asia, because what we're engaged in now is a great transformation of the noosphere. That's the way to look at it. We've got to transform the biosphere and the noosphere into forms which are both sound scientifically and also in the interest of mankind. Therefore, as we look at the Central Asia and North Asia as of Eurasian cooperation, the question of the ecological development, the biospheric development, the neo-noosphere development of Central Asia and of into the tundra regions of North Asia is the key part of the development of the Eurasian continent. My view is Russia is a Eurasian nation. It is not simply in Europe and Asia, but it is Eurasian in character. It has Eurasian instincts as a nation, as a national body. It has ties to Russia, to China, to India, to other countries, which are crucial, which are unique. That doesn't mean that India and China always agree with Russia, but it means it's a bridge country between Western Europe and the countries of East and South Asia. And therefore, in a sense, my concern is to get Russians to adopt that view, and thus to help to bring together, for example, let's take the question of bilateral relations between China and India, which are much discussed here. And our goals are much discussed in China as well.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
How do you deal with the fact that, especially since 1962, there has been a continuing sense of a potential military conflict between Russia and China, China and India, which affects all of us? How do you bring these nations together? How do you define a common interest over and above this continuing issue of conflict? I suggest, as also every Asian nation, as East Asia and so forth, is inherently in conflict. Korea with Japan, Japan with China, and so forth. Southeast Asia the same. Within Southeast Asia, within Indonesia, there's conflict. So the problem of Asia is these conflicts, these traditional and other conflicts, which make it difficult to set up any long-term durable agreement, especially on a bilateral basis. My view is that on a multilateral basis, if we can create a platform of common interest, which is more compelling than any bilateral conflict, that nations will find the impulse to overcome the causes of bilateral conflict and come to a durable sense of common interest. And I think that Russia is a nation which has come through Tsarism, communism, and worst of all, liberalism. And it now hates the stuff in a world which has to abandon economic liberalism as the price of its survival. You cannot be an economic liberal and actually expect to contribute much to the survival of your nation in any part of the world today. So therefore, we need to create a platform of perceived common interest in a new order of relations among sovereign states. And Russia, I think, is prepared to play that role, whereas nations such as Italy, Germany, France are not.
You would have, I think, Mr. Kapoor, and then Mr. Yadav.
I would just like to make a small comment that I think one of the most significant things which you have said in your speech here is that and which we are confronted with in India in the process of our development towards the future is the destruction of the nation state. You said destruction of the nation state to a considerable extent has been realized in Africa, has been largely realized through genocide or whatever argument you may have. Now, to destroy a nation state like India, which is 6,000-7,000 years of history, and which is still not destroyed after 500 invasions and 300 years of colonialism, we are still around. Yeah. Why are we around? Why is this nation not destroyed? So I would say that behind that is the cultural situation in India. There is a hidden psychic link which connects people all the way from the lowest corridors of India to the north. That hidden psychic link. Now somehow, whenever endeavor has been made to destroy the nation state, they have first to destroy the culture. Because without the destruction of the culture, the destruction of the nation state cannot take place. So that is why, amongst the things which you are seeing today happening in this country, is an attempt on the culture. Whether you creating differences between Muslims and Hindus, which were in a pluralistic country, which accepted everything, which allowed everybody to come in, that break is taking place. They are trying to create rifts between the Christians and the Hindus, who protected the Christians in the earlier years to come to India. Same, the whole process. So therefore, I think it is the most significant thing. Globalization cannot function without the destruction of the nation state. And the nation state cannot be destroyed unless first we destroy the culture. So the process which is going on today is the process of destruction of cultures. Culture of the tribal cultures of Africa, tribal cultures of Latin America, tribal cultures of many of the other countries of the world. This is what is happening. Now therefore, in fact, anything which India or any country of this part can do, I feel will only be possible if we can protect that pluralistic culture of this country which allowed the germination of all kinds of things which happen in India. So under the circumstances, I feel the most important element today is how to protect, number one, the destruction of the culture. Number two, how to protect the destruction of our cultures. Firstly, it is how to protect our culture. Secondly, the most important thing is that how to bring about that during the period of transition, which you have said that the financial system is breaking down, how do we see that before the system really breaks down, there is something very positive visible which can become acceptable to a large mass of the people around the world. Otherwise, attempts will be made. As from colonialism, you went to Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods, you moved to the next stage to bring in this parity, I mean this whole different currencies. And now something else is being done. The same thing will happen again. We have to see that that doesn't happen. This is the key to my...
I want to say one thing quickly on this. I think it's extremely important that that publication be widely circulated among relevant Indian circles. So to know, and this should be circulated worldwide, to understand one of the problems, what you reported to me in this respect, explained something to me which had been mystified me recently on an encounter I had on just this issue, and I couldn't understand why the Clinton circles would be so enraged and so upset about this question. You explained it to me by pointing to that Cato Institute et al. Business.
Thank you.
And I think it's extremely important that that be publicized widely, and that it be publicized widely among relevant Indian circles, so they know exactly what the problems were in the Clinton policy toward India and Asia generally, and understand some of the problems which spill over through State Department circles in dealing with India now.
I must introduce myself, of course. Jagdeep Yadav, former Union Minister, ex-member of Parliament, as my friend K.R. Ganesh sitting by my side. I think that you are visiting India after 20 years. 17 years. Even that is a very long period. I wish you could visit more often to this part of the world, not only India, Russia, Southeast Asia, China. Because as you rightly said that this part of the world will play a very important role in shaping the new just economic order. And I think that one lesson which is good in a sense that after 11 September, which was a very tragic event, but I think that the whole world must try to learn the lesson from that tragic event that why these things have happened. Why terrorism was not taken note of earlier, and why all of a sudden now terrorism has become the main target for international community. I think that there are several injustices going on. As you said very rightly, that economic must be for the poor. The mission of economic is not only to create wealth and to create more wealth and go for greater development and create different kind of monetary system, but its aim and its mission should be to, for the welfare of the human being, to create, to diminish or eliminate poverty, which is on a very large scale in the whole world today, and growing unemployment, at the same time growing disparities. And therefore social tension is also increasing very much. One objective of the present world system does not seem only to dominate certain capitalist world, do not want only to dominate the whole world, but also they are making the entire humanity as the victims of materialism. The one major problem in my opinion is the growing sense of materialism and also consumerism. Because today the whole effort of the capitalist world is to create a system or a society of consumerism, make individual and human beings totally materialistic, and as you very rightly said that you have a sense of spiritualism, but one target seems to be destroy spiritualism, and that is, another major danger. So the entire developing countries are today, they are being subjected to a new kind of economic imperialism. As you made a very significant remark that there is, Africa has become woman's land. It's a major continent. But now, first target was Africa, destroy that continent, make them totally subjugate and dependent on others. And now they are making efforts really to make the entire developing countries as dependent on them. I very highly appreciate your concern for the developing countries, especially for Asia and also for India. Otherwise, in 1981, you would not have taken care to produce a 40-year plan for the development of India. That shows your concern also, and your friendly feeling for Indian people, which I very much appreciate. I will say that you seems to be speaking with a strong sense of conviction that the present monetary system, international monetary system, is finished, has no future. But it has to have some kind of alternative system. There has to be some kind of alternative system. I would like you to kindly throw more light that when this present international monetary system is finished, then what kind of alternative system will emerge at the world level as well as at the regional levels, and especially for the developing countries, because the basic problem today of that two-third population live in these countries, and they are the main sufferers. They do not seem to have any future. Even in our country, I would just like to bring to your notice, I am sure that seeing your interest in India, you must be doing. But just to remind you that our 52 and 53 years of our independence, almost one-third of our population, and when I say one-third, it means almost 30 to 40 crores of people. 300 to 400 million people, it's not a small population, they are still living below poverty line. And that poverty line is inhuman poverty line. Even safe drinking water is not available to them. Another one-third of our population, besides this below economic poverty, is living a very substandard living. So two-thirds of India, it means 600 to 800 million people in India are living a very substandard living life. What future is for them? If we become only the victim of the present exploiting system, and as you very rightly said, I am very glad that you have a very original idea, that we are speaking of making some reforms within this existing system that won't work. There has to be some alternative path of development. There has to be some alternative path of ideas and thinking and a vision. After all, human being is not only just to live from one day to another day. Then we must build a prosperous, a cultured thinking society. So I think that these ideas have to be discussed at length. As Professor Kaushik said, very unfortunately, because you are visiting after a long time, some of your ideas through your magazines are known to people, but they are known only to the intellectual people. It should be more known to the common people, more thinking people. And once, if you visit more, I am sure that there will be people to organize a large-scale discussion with you. you have some very original ideas, and those ideas have to be discussed. So I'm saying that in India we have, as I said, 2/3 population living some standard of life. We have in India between the age group of 6 and 14 our children, 60% are not going to school. And if they are going, then within 2 or 3 years they are large-scale dropouts. Our women, 56% of our women are illiterate. They have not been able to go to school because of poverty, because of the social system. We do not want that, I am not using that word, Taliban people may misunderstand, and I don't want to use that. But what unfortunately happened in Afghanistan in the last few years, closing school for girls, destroying schools, making them like live a life of animals. So I am saying that these are the problems of Asia, problems of Africa, problems of even Latin America, and I say in a sense, the problems of 2/3 people in the whole world. So, I am glad that you visited, and I am glad to Mr. Mehta, who provided us some opportunity informing us that you are visiting Delhi, and therefore we are able to come and have some kind of understand your ideas, your vision, and also some kind of dialogue. I wish, and I thank you again, and I wish to visit India soon. Thank you very much.
You have just Malcolm Pearson, Globalism, Ecology. I'd like you to explain about the ecology part. Globalization will suffer. Malcolm Pearson.
The ecology idea was developed by the group of Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells and their associates, and was foisted upon the world under the infamous book published in 1928 by Wells called The Open Conspiracy. And you find the essentials of the program are there. This idea, of course, came from progenitor of H.G. Wells, Thomas Huxley, who created Wells out of nothing. This comes from the ideology of the Haileybury School, this comes from Benthamism, and so forth. And they're spread around the world with the idea that if you accept the idea that man should not alter nature, that there is a balance in nature which is predetermined, and he must not alter it, that what you will do by simply making that demand, you will ensure genocide. Now, Wells made it clear, as did Russell, that genocide was desirable, and technological and scientific progress had to be stopped in order to promote genocide, to keep the world's population within dimensions which they found agreeable, and to keep people as stupid as possible by denying them making them hate technology. Making them hate the science and technology, which is what you get in most of these crazy terrorist movements which are created, are generally anti-scientific, anti-humanistic movements. This came into vogue on a popular basis with the Indochina War period. It was established as international policy by the British government, by British intelligence. To people like Dr. Alexander King and others, it was spread into the Soviet Union through the International Institute for Systems Analysis. It was an operation which was run by Cambridge University, the Cambridge Systems Analysis Group. It was spread throughout the world. It was spread in India widely by the associates and followers and networks of Bertrand Russell, who, for me, presented this argument. So this is a form of insanity. If you look at the way to approach this problem is as I have done. And on this account, the ideas of Vernadsky are extremely important. Vernadsky defined the biosphere in a rigorous way from the standpoint of geology, and does that by fundamental scientific discovery and applying those discoveries to increase the potential population density and power of the individual member society. And therefore, any intervention against that is anti-spiritual, is a violation of the rights and nature of man. But this is what's being done. The biggest source, the biggest argument for the destruction of civilization, which has occurred in the past 31 years, has been based on the spread of the doctrine of ecology. For human ecology, the point is the job is the question of national, governmental, and world policy. Our job is to improve the biosphere for man's existence, not to destroy it. That's why you have to have a scientific approach. You can't have an arbitrary approach of any kind. For example, we need to increase the power of the biosphere as a whole, which means you have to increase high-grade biomass. For example, forestation in the Dakar. You need to change. You need to change the water transport systems to transform deserts in places. You have to manage the oceans. You have to manage the land for mankind. You have to take the same approach to the planet Earth that you would attempt to take in Earth forming the moon, the Earth, Mars, for example. For example, if we're going to put scientific stations on Mars, and we have reasons to do so. If we put the scientific stations on Mars, we're going to have to create a synthetic environment beneath the surface of Mars. And we're going to have to know how to do it. When you put people in space, well, you've changed a lot of things about human life is going into space. These are not the same conditions which human life was designed on Earth. Therefore, you have to know how to deal with these policies. So therefore, you have to have a science. That's why I push this. I push this question. You must have a scientific approach to this question and use Vernadsky and his concept of biosphere and nosphere and use that as science and say, we must look at how we manage our planet and beyond from the standpoint of science. And therefore, national policy and national law must be based on science, not the kind of pseudoscience which present-day ecology represents.
I would like you to remember the object concept here. Just explain your analysis of the September 11th events.
The September 11th events for an attempted military coup d'etat inside the United States against the presidency of George Bush. There was an earlier reference to this question about terrorism. We use the term terrorism, but I try to define terrorism as an independent category. That is a big mistake. It's a mistake in discussion of the situation in Afghanistan now. That is not the issue. We have things that are called terrorism. What we have really is under the conditions of nuclear supremacy, nuclear weapons supremacy, that major powers resorted to use of what is called irregular warfare as a substitute for regular warfare. See, from the period of the various things that developed in the 16th century around Leonardo da Vinci and Machiavelli, the concept of warfare suited for modern civilization was defined. And during the 18th century, as a result of the American Revolution, the result of the reforms of particularly by Carnot in France and by Scharnhorst in Germany, you have reforms in military art which gave to the modern regular armies and the idea of the rule of law. The Treaty of Westphalia was a key part in European history of defining a rule of law concerning warfare. And unfortunately, that's been abandoned today. The reason we had that law, we realized the danger inhering in religious warfare and ethnic warfare. That is, people must not kill one another because of ethnic issues. They must not kill one another over religious issues. This is the essence of the progress of modern European civilization is presumably working. So what we did, having reached with World War II, the highest rate of development of modern warfare, we immediately retreated from modern warfare to submodern warfare, a decadent form which is called irregular warfare.
regular warfare are means other than uniformed, acknowledged military means to accomplish political aims like those of warfare within one's own country or in foreign countries. For example, there is no such thing as international terrorism. International terrorism is only what we call irregular warfare, which is organized by governments. Now, I've done a number of studies of a number of terrorist organizations. None of them are independent. Independent terrorist organizations either do not exist or they don't survive very long. An independent terrorist organization, God's on the street, is going to be wiped out very quickly by any government. The only way in which a terrorist organization can flourish under the pretext of being independent is because some government or similar authority is protecting it, which controls governments. Huh? Now, in this case, you have a development of this in an extreme form. In the 1970s especially, the start of the 1960s, late 1960s, the development of terrorism to promote a post-industrial society. That was the original purpose. That continued into the 1970s. In the 1970s, we had, with Kissinger and Brzezinski as national security advisors, you had a new form of, particularly after the SALT agreements of 1972, you had now the use of irregular warfare as a surrogate for warfare between the United States and the Soviet Union, an extension of what happened in Vietnam.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.